I have
current geek.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is the Current Geek Film Festival, a monthly special look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky perspective. I'm Scott Johnson, he's Tom Merritt, and this week we're talking about the movie The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Badges?
This is the movie.
I don't got to show you no badges.
Yeah, it's not how I remember it, though. It's different. I always thought it was, we don't need no...
Let's just get this one out of the way at the beginning. This is the movie that spawned the badges, we don't need no stinking badges, which is one of those quotes that isn't what they said.
Right. It's a Mandela effect quote, once again.
Yeah.
Where it's more like, I should have captured it, but it's more like, we don't need to show you any badges. Like, it's just a different... The line's just different, but as soon as I heard it...
The line is, badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
There you go. Yeah.
So the quoted line should be, I don't have to show you any stinking badges. But it's not. And in the book that this is based on, it's like dirty.
Oh, really?
It's like, badges? To goddamn hell with badges. We have no badges. In fact, we don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges, you goddamn cabron.
Wow. They went hardcore.
And then something that is not nice in Spanish that I won't repeat.
All right. Well, all of that other stuff was nice.
It's even less nice than what I just said. Yeah. I know.
Well, that's interesting because honestly, going into this movie, I didn't know that was even going to be a line. I didn't know that was the reference for this. And I've heard it a million times.
Like, I wasn't expecting it. And yeah. When it showed up, I was like, oh, I think I knew this at one point and forgot it.
Right.
You know, there was that kind of feeling. But yeah, it took me, I'm like, oh, right. This is the movie that badges that we all quote and nobody knows what it's from.
Yeah, exactly. So this is an old movie, 1948. It's on the list. It is kind of weird in that I thought John Huston only did Westerns. I don't know why I thought that, but he doesn't.
Well, and this is kind of a Western.
Kinda, sorta.
It is considered to be in the Western genre, broadly speaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's set in the 40s, so it's set when it was made.
The book is set in the 20s.
Oh, okay. Well, the movie wasn't clear about that. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, because the novel is from 1927, so they set the movie in the 20s, but then they couldn't afford to get all the cars off the street in Tampico because they shot parts of this movie in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So they just left the anachronistic cars out there.
Yeah. That's what threw me. I think some of the stuff like that still, it looked like, you know, era appropriate for when the film was made, but I guess it doesn't honestly matter all that much. Once they get up in the mountains, it just becomes kind of rustic Western.
Yeah. It's timeless up there.
Yeah.
Sure.
No big deal. But, yeah, this is a film I've never seen. You've never seen it. I've heard of it. I wasn't sure what to make of it, and now I'm really not sure what to make of it.
I used to get this confused with African Queen, which is another Bogart movie, although that one's in color. Mm. In my head, I would get them confused, and I will never make that mistake again now that I've seen it.
So still Bogart looking 60 when he's probably 30.
Right. Well, is 60 when he was 10, 60 when he's 30. Like,
he's an odd dude, but I've never seen him in a beard before, so that was kind of cool.
Didn't he die at 59,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, he died very young. Yeah, he died younger than he ever looked.
Yeah, exactly. Weird. He was 57 when he died. So yeah, he never made it to 60.
That's too young. It's a lot of cigarettes, though. But yeah, he smoked a lot. I think that's what the difference was with those people. But anyway, this is a very different role because we're used to seeing him as the hero or sometimes reluctant hero. And this, he's just kind of a jerk and a bastard by the end. You know, like I don't have a lot of sympathy for his character, the way things sort of turned out. And this movie takes like three or four major twisty turns that make you think, oh, this is when his character finds the right path or he does the right thing. And he never does. It just goes south for that dude.
In fact, I think there was, I'm trying to find the quote. I think there was it may be apocryphal story of someone asking Bogart about his role in this. And he's like, oh, you just wait till you see what a jerk I am in this movie.
Yeah.
Cause I think he relished the idea that he wasn't the good guy.
Yeah. He was a jerk, like a grade A jerk. And, didn't expect that. Cause I figured scene opens with him or the movie opens with him. I figure he's your antagonist or your protagonist the entire time. I thought that other guy that joined them, I thought it was going to go that way.
Here it is. Bogart encountered a critic while leaving a New York nightclub and said, "Wait till you see me in my next picture. I play the worst shit you ever saw."
That's cool. Salty Bogart. I like that. Sounds like something you'd order at a restaurant, doesn't it? A
salty Bogart. Yes. I'll have the salty Bogart, please. Hold the milk.
Doesn't sound good. But anyway, yeah, that was a turn that I didn't expect. I thought he would be our hero, and he was not. And other characters who I thought were super bit characters and sort of not, you know, they aren't your main, they're not the marquee names.
Right, like Tim Holtz, Curtin.
Yeah.
And Walter Houston was kind of a marquee name.
Sure.
He played the old guy.
Howard. Yeah, but in the actual credits, it's like, here's Bogart's name, because that's who was hot then, and you put his name up there, but... What a weird, I mean, is that why this movie's on the list? I mean, I don't want to, we can talk about its other virtues in a second, but it feels like one of the main reasons you might put this on the list is because it breaks type. It says, hey, what if he was bad? And what if things didn't go the way you expected? And what if this isn't like every other movie?
That might be part of it is Bogart showed his range. Mm-hmm. Like he didn't have to play the pretend bad guy who does good. He could just be bad, and I think the other reason this is on the list is you didn't have a lot of movies where you see so much unnecessary death. When Curtin goes down, you think that's it.
Yeah.
You think he killed him. And then of course we find out like, oh, he survived and he crawled away. And in a sense, it's kind of a trope because the good guys win, the bad guy loses, but it looks like the bad guy's going to win for a long time. It's got a fairly complex development line for a movie of that time, for sure.
Oh yeah. For a movie in the 40s, that is the one thing that struck me, is the story progression and the character development went in places that went against what I normally think of from that time.
Yeah. This story would hold up. We could talk later on whether we should, but you could make this story now and it would hold up. People wouldn't poke holes in it as being, paper thin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could do it. And also I actually think they should do it because, stuff is cheesy in the 40s. It's just,
some of the dialogue got you. Is that what you're saying?
Some of it's real, real weird. Like this first, I'm going to play a couple of clips. Here's one where he's begging for food and it's fine. It's not the worst dialogue, but it gives you an idea of the tone of the film. Here you go.
Will you just take a fellow American to a meal?
Such impudence never came my way.
Early this afternoon, I gave you money. While I was having my shoes polished, I gave you more money. Now you put the bite on me again. Do me a favor, will you? Go occasionally to somebody else. It's beginning to get tiresome.
Oh, excuse me, mister. I never knowed it was you. I never looked at your face. I just looked at your hands and the money you gave me. Beg pardon, mister. I promise I'll never put the bite on you again.
This is the very last you get from me.
So standard stuff, but again, it's in that cadence, right? That kind of 40s, like, man, listen here, will you?
This is the last you get from me.
Yeah.
You ain't putting the bite on me again, see?
Yeah. A lot of will yas. Like, will ya? Stop it, will ya? And like a lot of will yas in there, which is a funny thing to hear. But
the will ya effect.
I think that you could remake this movie in now and give it the cadence and vocabulary of today, and it would work. I think the structure is actually pretty good.
I mean, did it bother you, that cadence? Because I took that as a positive of like, oh, we get in that sort of 20s, 30s era patter. I liked that.
I mean, I usually do.
Yeah,
so
I know.
I'm normally with you on this. For some reason, it rubbed me the wrong direction this time. It was against the grain for me. And I don't know why. I don't know what it is. I think maybe...
Is it because it's out of place? You expect it in a noir film. You expect it in a detective film, a gangster film. You don't expect it in a Western.
Yeah, I'll say that that's a fair way of putting it. Like John Huston's other Western films that were, explicitly Western, John Wayne stuff and all that, they had a very different kind of take on how people communicated, and
a lot of partners, not Williams.
Yeah, and they this seemed to just kind of jam the two together, which is okay. And it's not that it's bad. It's hard for me to explain, but it really came off discordant.
It stuck out to you.
Yeah, it was discordant.
Took you out of
it
a little bit.
But then later, there were moments where it was like, oh, geez, what's he? He's really losing it. And when he shot that guy, it was a fairly intense moment. He's a terrible shot, clearly. Point blank where, like, I don't know what happened there. That was just dumb. But,
In some sentences, I also like that, it's not playing by the movie rules of when you shoot someone, they're dead.
Yeah.
Right. Because in real life, when you shoot someone, quite often they don't die.
Right.
They may die later. They may be injured. It's harder to shoot and kill someone than people think.
Right. It's but
and it this did, felt like it was playing with the real rules of the world.
Correct. And that when he got hit with the, I guess it's a spoiler, but hey, it came out in 48. So sorry, everybody. But
yeah,
but
we're always spoilery on these things. We're going to assume you either don't care or you've watched it.
But when he gets hacked to death with a machete, I was convinced that they would do what they first did, which is it'll be a little bit off camera. They're not going to be gratuitous about it. It's not going to be a lot of blood or whatever. But they're only going to do it once, one stab and we're done. Nope. That guy came in there for two major big old hacks and it made a horrible sound. And it was almost worse than if I'd seen the gory demise. That got me, dude. I was like, whoa, 1948.
What are it's you- interesting that you say that because the original edit showed the head coming off.
Oh, geez.
Dobbs was decapitated and obviously fake head rolled into the water hole with a quick shot of Gold Hat's accomplices reacting to it. That reaction shot remains in the film. And in the very next shot, we see the water rippling where it rolled in. But you saw the head roll in and the censors said no. So they cut the shot with a repeat shot of the Gold Hat striking Dobbs. So that's why you see two. Originally, it was just one. Head comes off. You see it roll into the water and that's it. But the censors wouldn't allow it.
So they get what the compromise was. All right, we get two hacks at it if we can't show this head rolling in the water.
Yeah, I guess so.
Which is, again, still seems so hardcore for 1948 to me. Like, I don't know what I think. I mean, a lot of movies, I guess, did stuff that for its time pushed the envelope. But this was like.
I mean, it's not Reservoir Dogs, but for its time, it's kind of Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. There was a brutality to it I didn't expect. I mean,
they had more graphic things happen before the movie code came into effect in the 30s.
That's true.
But this is the, you know, this is the high period of the movie code. You don't do stuff that the censors don't want you to.
What do you think? What would those movie code people think of us today? If we could teleport them to the future, how would they feel?
The Hays Code folks, yeah, they would just be like, this is awful.
They wouldn't know what to do with themselves. Like, it'd be so far gone, they would be like, well, just, you know, show them a single film. Like,
you can't do that, is what they would say to pretty much everything.
Yeah, everything. There are PG-13 movies that people think are pretty innocuous. Yeah. Like, you couldn't do Lord of the Rings now. Or with them.
Because it's not just swearing.
Right.
I mean, swearing was out, but it's not just that. It was what you were allowed to show, both sexuality and violence.
Yeah. Yep. A lot of short kisses.
A lot of implied fade to black comes from that era.
Yeah. Very dramatic deaths that don't really match up to reality or whatever. But anyway, I was convinced that that the dude who shows up midway was going to be a problem. And I want to play him real quick because he sounds like my brother. So none of you have really heard my brother Mark say anything.
Wait, this is the guy who figures out that they're up there mining, Cody?
Yeah, and decides to go up with him and ends up getting killed in the gunfight.
Yeah, okay.
Turns out he's a very sympathetic character. We don't know that till, you know, we read the letter to his wife or whatever, but or the wife to him. But anyway, here's him. And if anyone wanted to know what my brother Mark sounds like, this is basically a perfect rendition. Here you go.
They've been here several days, drinking and shooting off their cannons. The villagers are afraid to stick their noses out of their huts.
That's totally him. That's what my brother sounds like.
I've been here several days, Scott. And all your geek friends are afraid to stick their noses out of their rooms.
I've been to this family reunion for too many days now, see? He doesn't exactly do that 20s thing, but he does. He definitely has the sound of that guy. But so back to him, though. I was sure this movie's just going to do the easy thing, which was, hey, there's an interloper, and he's going to screw everybody. And maybe he was at some point. I don't know. But I was sure that's how it was going to go. And this is where... what's his name was going to find his heroism and he was going to defend
Dobbs.
His friends. Yeah. Dobbs would defend his friends. And that just does not go the way I expect at all. So I guess the movie surprised me a lot more than I expected.
Well, and the interesting thing about Cody is you think it's going to be either they cut him in and Dobbs is going to stew about it and maybe kill him in his sleep or something, or Dobbs is going to shoot him right then. But instead they just pull the rug out and be like, guess what? Everybody has more problems to deal with than just Cody, because an entire troop of banditos is on its way. And you get the amazing Jose Torve showing up. And of course, that's where the famous badges line comes in.
He's great. Everybody looks a little too Pepe Le Pew for me. Or not Pepe Le Pew. Who am I thinking of? Who's the cartoon?
Yeah, Pepe Le Pew is a skunk.
Speedy Gonzalez is what I meant, the mouse.
Speedy Gonzalez. Yeah. Well, Speedy Gonzalez, the problem here is these guys came first.
Right.
Actually, I don't know if that's true.
Well, they're all remnants of the 40s, I think. But maybe this was first. Those guys came later. I don't know. But it definitely had that stereotype going.
Speedy Gonzalez first appeared in 1953. So,
okay. That makes sense.
Treasure of Sierra Madre can say, we were just trying to depict what 20s era bandits would have looked like. And then Speedy Gonzalez ruined it for everyone.
I mean, to their credit, they used a lot of Latin actors. You know, they didn't
Mexican actors.
Yeah. They didn't go, you know, to Hollywood and just say, all right, paint your faces and talk with a bad accent. Which,
well,
because
they actually shot in Mexico.
Yeah.
They shot in Tampico.
Yeah. Credit for that. Because normally that's the stuff you expect from 40s Hollywood is kind of, you know, putting on a little blackface and pretending. Especially Indians and stuff, or Native Americans at the time, were always portrayed by just some white dude. With some
they shot in Tampico in the state of Durango. And Jose Torve is from Durango. Has a pretty good credits list. I mean, he's an amazing actor.
Yeah, he was good. I liked him in this a lot. And I don't think I was really familiar with his work until this. I probably am, and I just don't know it. But
sure, yeah, you probably are. He did a lot of Spanish language movies, of course, along with a lot of Hollywood movies.
Have you ever been tempted when you see something this old and that had this big of an impact? Do you ever feel like, I should read that 1935 novel it's based on? Have you ever done that?
So this is the first time that I'm looking at the novel and I'm like, I don't know, the novel may be even more interesting than the film. Because mm-hmm. There's a whole story about The Treasure of the Sierra Madre by B. Traven from 1935. Mm-hmm. The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is one of those few films where they just kept the name for the book. Like, if you've noticed, a lot of times when we talk about a movie based on a book, they've changed the name. Mm-hmm. This one is one of those few examples where they didn't. And the novelist, no one knows who it is even to this day.
Oh, really?
It was published in Germany. It's fairly certain that this was a German who lived in Mexico and wrote from his own experiences under the name B. Traven, but B. Traven was not his name. Mm. And the publishers didn't know who he was. They're like, we send the money to this address and that happens. However, in all the depictions of, you know, discussing the filming, there's talk that Traven was on set. Traven was asked if he'd like to visit the set during the shooting, but he demurred. And sending an associate, but the associate was actually Traven himself.
Wow.
Possibly. Although that needs a citation. Like, that's not known for sure. So there's a whole separate episode of Current Geek we could do about the book, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and the whole mystique around it. And Traven, this was not his only novel, but certainly his most famous because it was turned into this movie, which is so widely loved.
Yeah. There's a quote for the book in Amazon. They don't have it for Kindle. They have it on a couple of paperback and hardcover versions. It says here, little is known for certain about B. Traven. Evidence suggests he was born in Otto Fieg in Schleswig-Holstein, wherever that is.
Schleswig.
There you go. Schleswig. And that he escaped a death sentence for his involvement with the anarchist underground in Bavaria. Traven spent most of his adult life in Mexico, where under various names, he wrote several bestsellers and was an outspoken defender of the rights of Mexico's indigenous people. First published in 35, the Sierra Madre book was his most famous and enduring work, the dark, savagely ironic, and riveting story of three down-and-out Americans hunting for gold.
And he wrote the badges line. Just used it in the movie.
That's pretty great. Here is another scene where someone's very angry.
My, what great prospectors. Two shoe clerks reading the magazine about prospecting for gold in the land of the midnight sun, south of the border, west of the Rockies.
Shut your trap. Shut up, or I'll smash your head flat.
Go ahead. Throw it. If you did, you'd never leave this wilderness alive. Without me, you two would die here more miserable than rats.
Jeez. They were having a moment there.
Oh, Walter Houston. I actually have to say, I think Walter Houston is the best in this of all of them. I love the character of Howard. I love the way Houston plays him. And he's just so practical. He's like, I've lived my life. I've seen this all. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that must be based on someone Traven knew. Yeah. And Houston just totally turned, you know, I mean, he's doing a movie for his son, right?
Yeah. Oh, I was going to ask, were they related? I don't actually know that.
Yeah. It's his father.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Imagine that, directing your dad.
Yeah,
in a movie. Wow, that must have been
Houston,
something.
And John Houston originally wanted Ronald Reagan as James Cody. Can you imagine if that was Walter Houston, Humphrey Bogart, the guy who played Curtin, of course, Tim Holt, and Ronald Reagan in this movie.
That would have been something else. Yeah, Reagan didn't get, he ended up not being in movies that everyone thinks are giant classics. Reagan was in, like, you know, Win One for the Gipper or whatever it was called. And
yeah, yeah.
They're boring and dumb. Like, he's not on our list, I don't think. But that's too bad. He would have been here because he'd have been fine. I could see it. Could have played that guy. That guy wasn't anything special. But anyway, I'm kind of curious about this book now.
Apparently, Traven didn't want Walter Houston to play Howard. He preferred Lewis Stone. But again, I think Walter Houston's Howard is the best work in this.
So to this day, we don't know his name, his real name, this guy.
B. Traven? Yeah. No, nobody knows who he was for real. Yeah.
Wow, he has a bunch of books.
By the way, Walter Houston won Best Supporting Actor Oscar for that.
Oh, wow.
For that role as well.
He probably deserves it. He was very good.
John Huston won Best Director, won Best Adapted Screenplay, did not get Best Picture. Who got Best Picture in 1949? Let's see. Who took it away?
Forrest Gump. Oh, no. Sorry. I'm thinking of another
Oscar
robbery.
Goes to Hamlet.
Oh.
Laurence Olivier.
Okay, sure. So hold on.
What are you gonna do?
Who sorry, my brain just went dead. Did our main character or our main actor, Holt, did he win that year too? Was he nominated?
No.
Oh, see, I'm going to argue something here. I think Bogart's performance here is better than anything we've seen him in for this series yet.
Are you talking about Dobbs or Holt?
Dobbs, sorry.
Yeah. Dobbs. Holt was the name of the actor who played Curtin.
Right, I keep goofing
Dobbs
those guys up.
Was the name of Bogart's character.
Bogart's character, though. Bogart's performance as that character is, I mean, in some ways super over the top. But for its time, I feel like I like it better than I, this is sacrilegious to you, but I liked it better than I did the, you know, Play It Again, Sam movie and all that kind of stuff. Like, I
Casablanca?
Think, yeah.
Well, I'll try to still be your friend. But okay.
I feel like he was really good in this. And maybe it's just because he played against type and I dig that. You know, like, is the reason I like Chris Evans so much.
He would have been up for Best Actor, but he didn't get a nomination for it.
That's interesting.
Laurence Olivier won for Hamlet. Yeah. And then the other nominees were Lou Ayers in Johnny Belinda, Montgomery Clift in The Search, Dan Daly in Where My Baby Smiles at Me, and Clifton Webb is Sitting Pretty.
Wow. All those names are.
Humphrey Bogart did not get a nomination for Best Actor in the Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
What I would have done, or what I'm comparing it to, is Chris Evans' performance in Knives Out, which is I'm not saying he'll win or get nominated even, but what I mean
is... You know what else? You know what the problem was for Bogart that year, I bet?
What's that?
I just noticed that Gay Dawn won Best Supporting Actress for Claire Trevor in Key Largo.
Oh...
He probably split the nominations because people were like, I liked Bogart in Key Largo. Well, I liked him in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Well, he was nicer in Key Largo.
So
okay.
He lost because everybody, he split the vote. Yeah. They who's the guy that split the vote for, I can't think of anyone's name today. The guy from Texarkana, he just died. He came and basically everyone thinks that Clinton got elected because of him. Can't think of his
Ross
name.
Perot.
Ross Perot. Ross Perot. Yeah. That's what I like to say is people got Ross Perot in this deal.
You're talking about a movie star. That's why I was like, what?
No, I couldn't think of it. It's one of those days, man. I don't remember anything today, but I like this movie. I remember it. It was good. I mean, I don't know. I'm still kind of torn though. It's got cheese in a setting that I don't normally have that cheese. And I think that's what threw me. I'm fine with it. It makes me want to go watch more John Huston movies, which has been ages anyway. I haven't seen like a lot of really old John Huston movies. I think he's going to show up again in our list as a director of other stuff. So I bet we're not done with John Huston. You'd probably tell me because you have the list. But yeah, like I really like this. It was different and I didn't expect it.
I get what you're saying about the cheese. To me, that just felt like a period appropriate.
Period cheese.
Because it was set in the 20s. So that never bothered me watching this. But if you get past that, I think the reason this is on the lists is because it's not just about gold. It's about character. Mm. In fact, Roger Ebert says the movie has never really been about gold, but about character. So I'm stealing Roger Ebert's thought there. But gold is your MacGuffin, right?
Right.
They go farther into it than they need to. They could just say, like, we're looking for gold. We found the gold. Here's the gold. And it would be just as good of a movie. But they show you what the gold mining really means. Like they get fairly gritty about like, well, you got to dig into the mountain and you got to pan it and you're looking for silt and it's not going to look like gold when you first find it, which of course that's important to set up the later issue when the gold goes away, because people looked at it and the gold hack guy just thought it was sand and got rid of it and it all blows away at the end. I think the fact that they tie this story of like what happens when people are isolated and their true nature comes out, you know, what can greed do to a man? Mm-hmm. What is the, and in the end, what are you really pursuing?
Sure.
Right. And I think that's, maybe that's why I like Walter Huston's role in this so much, is he is the character through this whole thing that says, it's all about the journey. From the very beginning, when they meet him in the hostel, he's like, yeah, you never really, it's never about the gold. I've had huge fortunes and they've gone away. Would I go again? Hell yeah, I'd go again. Cause it's all about the effort. It's all about finding it. That's right. Where the fun is.
Right.
If you get the gold at the end or not, it doesn't really matter because it doesn't stay. And it's funny to me to think back that that message is there so early in this movie. And yet you still see this drama unfold because you think, well, maybe they will make away with tens of thousands. And when Dobbs says, no, we should stick around and get 75,000, you think, ooh, this is a bad idea. But they ended up getting 100, you know, they ended up getting more than that. Mm-hmm. So it's such a lovely, subtle story underneath what appears to be just a, you know, a tradition, what would be a traditional gold hunt story.
Did you, so in the final scene where the little bag of gold seems to be kind of wrapped around a cactus, are we supposed to think that had gold in it and nobody checked, or was that just another sign?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think that's just showing that, you know, the bag of your dreams is empty, you know, okay. it's just litter. And it kind of underlines that idea that, you know, if you're chasing after gold, the gold isn't the satisfying part. It's the chase.
It's
and
the
Howard
chase
knows
and
that. Yeah. So he's fine with it.
Right.
That's why he's so blasé about all of this, but he also knows what it can do to men. And that's why he gets concerned when he starts seeing that happen to Dobbs, who's taking it seriously. And of course the lesson in the end is nobody got rich because everybody was greedy.
Part of me thinks that that movie with DiCaprio and Tom Hardy and the bear, I don't remember the name of it, is a few years ago. It won Best Picture.
Was it called The Bear?
No, it was like The Revenant. That's it.
The Revenant. Oh, right. Yeah.
The Revenant.
I knew which one you meant.
I'm now semi-convinced The Revenant is a light lifting of this story in its basic form. Because there is an entire chunk of that thing that is about them out traveling around. One of them gets greedy, kind of betrays everybody else. They get revenge in the end. It's not nearly as, it doesn't have the happy smiley, see you later, Howard kind of moment, but it has some of the same lessons, you know,
about it sounds like, and I haven't seen The Revenant. It's Treasure of the Sierra Madre without Howard.
Kind of. Yeah. I bet you'd like that. Cause not just cause of this, but this is very much that kind of story. And now it's hitting me what reminded me of this while I was watching it. Cause the whole time I'm like, no, I know this. And I know it plays with tropes and stuff that you'll find in other movies. And when I went into it, by the way, I thought I was getting like Indiana Jones style treasure hunt. Like, it just sounded like one, like Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Sounds like an old movie about, you know, somebody going to an ancient tomb and finding a bunch of treasure. And it just, I was sure that's what I was going to get. Instead of Tomb Raider, I got a very different movie. And I was delightfully surprised by it. Although it never is dark on his sets. Have you noticed this? Whether he's shooting outside or inside, John Huston's sets and lighting are the brightest they can possibly be. I don't know if that was just to create as much black and white contrast as possible or what was going on there. But man, you can pick him. It's his movies out of others by just going, yep, that's John Huston. How do you know? Everything is lit, like super lit.
Because everything is lit.
It's lit, son. But there's no like, you know, dark shadows and noir sort of techniques or any of that stuff. He just is, it's like sun's out, guns out, let's go. And I can always recognize that. But anyway.
It's been remade multiple times and it obviously has inspired like The Revenant. I'm sure there was a made for TV movie called Wet Gold.
Wet Gold
has been called the unofficial remake of Treasure of Sierra Madre. So it's more of an inspiring film because I think it sets a pattern. It's like this is the survival film pattern.
Yeah.
And that's what you're seeing in The Revenant, is them saying, well, we're going to make our version of that.
Right.
But Sierra Madre is the template for that.
Just feels like today you can get away with a grittier take. And if they made one with that name, I think I'd be into it. I think I'd be
would you stoked. Want it to be a period piece remake, like in the 20s?
Yes. I think that
with the actual cars being 20s era cars.
Yeah.
Or should it be a remake where it's in the 20s, but they still use 40s era cars?
I mean, I would like it to be a period piece regardless. And it needs to be something before the 60s, like just some.
Well, because I feel like the reason The Revenant is The Revenant is if you're going to make a modern version, the Treasure of the Sierra Madre isn't going to work.
Right.
Because you just use your cell phone, right? Like you have to put them farther in a more remote situation where it's believable that they couldn't have contacted anyone.
Or
right?
if you're going to do that, their phones need to break or fall off or run out. You know, you gotta
well,
do things.
Well, and the bandits, you know, would have to be different. They'd have to be, you know, guerrillas or cartel people, or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the whole situation just changes. But so, yeah, I'm with you. I would be curious to see if someone could take a stab at remaking this in the period, but with modern sensibilities.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
Although I still think the patter has to be the patter. That's the way people talked in the 20s, right? Mm-hmm. Or am I wrong?
No. I mean, I don't know. I assume because all the movies tell me that. I don't actually know.
All of our 100-year-old listeners, please write in and tell
that
us.
That would be, see, that's fascinating because we don't really have a good record of that. Or maybe we do. Maybe there's some wax cylinder somewhere with interviews or something.
Oh, yeah. There's newsreels from that era where you get real people talking. But it's so thin because nobody wanted reality then. They wanted it to be staged and presented well.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, it was only a year and a half after this that Walter Houston passed away. He was only 67 years old. And just looking at his bio here, he's got a lot of movies. Right. Man, that guy was busy.
I feel like, I mean, he made a lot of movies, so it's hard to say. This is definitely one of his best, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I'm honest, I can't think of anything I've ever seen. So for me, let's see. I'm just going to do a cursory look here. Yankee Doodle
Francis
Dandy.
Farmer Presents the TV series.
I have seen Yankee Doodle Dandy in some form somewhere, which was about a music composer or something. I don't remember what the deal was, but I remember that, but I don't remember him being in it. So yeah, for me, it'd be like a kid being born today going, oh yeah, George Clooney. He was great. But, you know,
remember him?
Yeah, I remember him. But this is going to be one day. Think about this for a second. Or maybe this is not. Actually, this is a great crossover question for all the other stuff we do, be it forecast or, in your case, tech stuff or anything. But because we live in the time we live in and the tech we have and the archival world we live in now, do you think, because I look at this list of names on this movie and I recognize Bogart and Houston, and that's it, kind of. Everybody else fades into the nothing. And all those names you mentioned that were up for Academy Awards that year, no, really no impact.
You know Laurence Olivier, right?
Yes, yes. Once in a while you hear a name.
The other ones are very, I mean, I know Montgomery Clift because of the song from, I think it's The Clash. It's Montgomery Clift.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot about that. But there's so many names in so many old movies and all the winners and all the directors, they're just names now. They don't have the heft or the meaning or the whatever. And I wonder if there's a time and a place where that happens to who we think of as big now. You know, does Brad Pitt's name just mean nothing to somebody in 50 years? I don't know. Or will they still look at it and go, oh no, Brad Pitt, he was big in the 80s, 90s and 2000s. And we'll never forget that because everything's streamed, everything's archived, everything's available. Everything's on your hollow headsets by the year 2050. Like, that fascinates me. Like how relevant will these people be? And at what point did they become more relevant? Is it because we're living now in this tech era, this tech heavy era, or what? I don't know.
It is always interesting. Like Humphrey Bogart is contemporary with all those names that you don't recognize, but you know him.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and part of that is because he was great and he was in, you know, we've seen multiple movies with him in them. Right. On this list. So he was in, you know, I don't think it's over the top to say he was in some of the best movies of all time.
You think kids, if you had guessed in 50 years, will kids know who Harrison Ford was? You think they will?
Yes. Okay. Harrison Ford feels like Humphrey Bogart in that he's been a lot of the most popular movies, but also the movies that stick around. Like, people still know Indiana Jones, right?
Right.
Kids these days don't go, wait, Indiana Jones, who's that? Obviously Star Wars. So, I think he will be remembered more than other contemporary actors.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't know why that fascinates me, but just this idea that they either fall into obscurity or we remember them forever.
Like, what makes them fall into obscurity and what does it? Now, on the one hand, you can say, well, they're in the greatest movies of all time that people keep watching and keep talking about, but that isn't always the case.
Right.
There are plenty of people in these movies that we've been watching that you and I both have said, like, oh yeah, I've never seen anything with that person in it before. And they're the main character.
Right. But like names like,
I mean, Charlie, Walter Houston for you is one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. One of those. I mean, I didn't even know he was his, I mean, I knew the name Houston and I know John Houston.
Right.
So that's a legendary name. So like Spielberg will probably live forever as a name, you know, George Lucas, maybe like, maybe, you know, maybe that's, maybe it really is the body of work and just how critically loved you are. And then that makes you just live forever. Then the obscurity comes from, ooh, great couple of performances, but then they kind of fell off and did a lot of direct-to-video stuff or something. I don't know. I like discussing that kind of stuff.
I think it's a little bit random what survives.
Yeah.
Because great things will fall into obscurity, right?
Mm. Yeah, that's and true.
Bad things stick around that shouldn't.
Right.
You know, people still remember bad television shows and bad movies, Plan 9 from Outer Space, etc. And some of it just, you know, it just has to do with chance. Like, what was it that caught a few people's attention? And it's like trying to figure out how something goes viral or how something becomes a meme.
Yeah, it's tipping point stuff.
Yeah.
I still know who Fatty Arbuckle is, even though it's got zip to do with anything. I've never seen a single movie he ever did, but because he was so controversial and got blacklisted.
Well, and also his name's Fatty Arbuckle. Like, that's a memorable thing. Name. You're not going to forget that one, is he?
Yeah. Like Rip Torn. Everyone will always remember Rip Torn. Probably,
yeah. And he's great.
Yeah.
We're rewatching Larry Sanders' show for, Cord Killers.
He's amazing, know? On there. So good.
Yeah.
He's so good. Oh, you guys are watching that. That's great.
After we did the autopilot, I threw it in the ring for Cord Killers library watch, and we've been doing it.
Nice. That sounds great. Any other thoughts? Oh, I did want to say this about the music. The music was fine. Max Steiner provided the score.
Two in a row for Max Steiner. He did the King Kong soundtrack
too. Oh, I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah.
10 years apart. That's crazy. Anyway, the thing I noticed about it is it was always trying to invoke cowboy and Indian kind of music. And so like when they would show the Mexican village, instead of getting kind of cool Mexican based song soundy anything, it was like a lot of like that kind of stuff. And I wonder if he was told it was a different movie and didn't know what he was scoring. That threw me kind of hard. I don't know if you noticed it, but I definitely noticed it.
Well, they did something progressive for 1948, I feel, which was have a separation between the native Mexican population and the Spanish descent Mexican population.
Right.
So they don't try to lump them all in together. Mm-hmm. So you have the bandits, mm-hmm. right? And probably some of those are of native descent, but they make a distinction between, well, there's the federales, right? And they're the no-nonsense ones that are like, you break the law, we shoot you.
Right.
Boom, that's right. It. Right. Then you have the bandits, and then you have the native tribe, and there's a whole separate like category for them. And Howard makes that clear. And they speak Spanish, of course, but Howard makes it clear, like, well, we're dealing with a different culture. So you have to sit down and wait for them to get to the point. This isn't like dealing with a European culture.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting that they made that point. Also thought it was interesting that you don't got no subtitles in this thing.
Yeah. That's true.
Spanish is Spanish, and if you understand it, great. And if you don't, well, you'll get it from the context.
Yeah, or Howard will tell you what they're saying. But that's
right.
There were moments where they went big strings of text or scenes where nobody knew. There was just all Spanish, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, when Dobbs meets Goldhat, mm-hmm. there's a lot of Spanish being spoken that Dobbs doesn't understand, and if you don't speak Spanish, neither do you.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice. It actually kind of worked for me though. I didn't mind it.
Well, again, it's more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
that because that's what would happen if you were in Mexico, right?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. If you were lined up for a firing squad, okay, this is Tom's time to go.
This never becomes a practical question, but carry on.
I hope not too, but let me ask you this because I know what I would do. If they said to me, all right, we're going to shoot you against this wall with a 12-man firing squad, but you need to dig your own grave first.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought about this too.
I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just say, dig your own freaking grave. You're about to shoot me. I'm not doing it. Well,
but historically, people do it.
Really?
Yeah. And I think I was thinking about this too. It's like, well, why would I dig my own grave and be like, just shoot me? Yeah. It's because it makes you live longer.
Oh.
So if you're playing for like, I don't know, maybe a pardon from the governor's going to come, or maybe it's just irrational. Like, well, I can either die now or I can live a little longer and dig this grave. Maybe people are like, you know what? I'll wring every minute out of life that I can and I'll dig the grave. Why not?
Okay. That makes more sense. Actually, it's kind of like when people say, do you have any final words? And then someone goes on and talks forever. It's like, it's just a weird, it's a psychological like thing where your final meal and the guy orders, you know, way too much food, like a way of extending things, making it
I think. Order. Yeah. And there's historical precedent for it. So it's not just a movie thing.
Yeah.
So I think what it is when people face that, like, wow, I'm really going to die, the instinct is to just delay that as long as possible. And if that means digging, then I guess I dig.
Yeah. When I first saw it, I just went, oh, just put that shovel down. What are you guys doing? You're doing manual labor. Yeah,
because it doesn't make any sense. Like no. you're getting what, you know, an hour of hard labor left before they kill you. Like, why? It doesn't. It's not rational.
Make the popo do it. They're the ones shooting you. They can put you in the ground. Anyway,
no, they'll just hire somebody. No one would.
Probably. All right. So, folks, we recommend you get it. I had to rent it. It's not streaming anywhere on a service other than rentals or buying. But it's available on Amazon, Apple movie stuff, and I saw it's one other place, and I forgot.
Where. Oh yeah, it's on the Google Play Store too.
That's right. It's around. Pretty much everywhere. It's one of those movies where I think you know. It's held in high regard, so you're always going to find a version of it somewhere. The Amazon prices were great because I rented it for $2.99. Normally, the HD version is more, but the HD and SD versions were the same. They were both $2.99.
Oh, you got a bargain. Nicely done.
I mean, not the...
Shop around, folks.
You don't gain that much from, you know, an HD version of this old of a thing, but it was still worth it. That thing is 4x3, which I thought was odd. I figured those were all... widescreen for some reason. I don't know why that one's not.
Mine was widescreen.
Maybe it was. Where'd you get it?
I don't remember.
Where'd you watch it?
I bought it from Fandango Now.
It's entirely possible that you got the cooler version. Mine was absolutely not even letterboxed.
Let me do a quick look because I can play it on my phone from my library. Maybe it'll tease. I have a lot of things in my library. I have to scroll for a bit.
Well, you're a guy who likes
if
your
you'll,
stuff.
If you'll bear with me.
I'm bearing with you and around you.
I'll be able
you.
To tell you. And I'm
bearing near you.
You can hear it, can't you?
Yep.
I got to go to a scene. No, you're right. It's 4:3.
Oh, weird. That's funny. Yeah, it's funny. I only noticed it because when I went full screen, I was like, oh, look at these big black bars on the side. And it just threw me for a minute. But it's cool. Worth seeing. I think our first John Huston film in our list, but I think there'll be more. So stick around for more John Huston in the future.
That old John Huston, he made some films.
He's a bit.
Some of them were considered really good.
Yeah. Busy. Most of them. He's a busy feller, that guy, or was.
He made Chinatown. Mm-hmm. That was one of his more Cannery Row.
Yeah. That's a good one.
And then, you know, of course, all of the fancy Westerns. He made Casino Royale.
Yeah. Huh. Well, the original, old one.
Treasure of the Sierra Madre was only his. What? No, I was looking at a different producer thing.
Oh, he made them for longer than you thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So all those things I was saying were things that he was, an actor in.
Mm. Oh, it just hit me. That makes Angelica Huston, John Huston's daughter, of course, and then the other Walter Huston's granddaughter. Weird. That's cool.
So he directed Prizzi's Honor.
Oh, okay.
He directed Under the Volcano.
Whoa. I didn't know that. I don't know what that is.
The Barbarian and the Geisha, African Queen, which is why I keep getting them mixed up.
Yeah.
The Red Badge of Courage, Asphalt Jungle, Key Largo. So he was against himself in 1948, Treasure of Sierra Madre. So he had started with the Maltese Falcon. So there you go.
Oh, Maltese Falcon.
Yep.
That's the one we've seen.
That's the one. So we have seen him.
All right. So two. We got two now.
And then he got pulled away to do wartime stuff.
Right. He did a bunch. Yeah, that was kind of like his service, sort of, mm-hmm. right? Like yep. he went over there and filmed a bunch of stuff. Him and, oh, there's a great documentary about these guys. I need to watch it. I keep hearing it's great. And now you've reminded me again, and I forgot the name. So this does no one any good. But there's a documentary where the people like Spielberg and Scorsese and all these big name directors talk about how impactful these wartime directors were for them and what they did when they went over there. It's supposed to be really good. So track that down, whatever it's called. Like I said, this helps no one. It's supposed to be really good.
Go find it. Good luck.
Go find it. Good luck, everyone. Now, next month, which is the first month of the brand new year of 2020, our first film will be, maybe appropriately, I don't know, Apocalypse Now.
You think it's going to be that kind of year, right?
I don't know. I think it'll be fine year. It's the year we're supposed to get a lot of neat innovations, so I'm focusing on that. I'm being very positive about 2020. But Apocalypse Now is the film, and it is from 1979.
Now, here's the thing. We should decide this right now.
Right.
There are like 15 versions of Apocalypse Now. Yeah. Actually, there's only three. There's Apocalypse Now Redux. Mm-hmm. There's Apocalypse Now The Final Cut. Mm-hmm. And there's Apocalypse Now as it was released in theaters originally.
If it were me. Oh.
I kind of feel like, if I can go first, I kind of feel like we should just see the one that was released in theaters.
The one that put it on the list in the first place.
Yeah, because exactly.
Okay, I think that's fair enough. The reason I recently saw the Final Cut, not that long ago, maybe a couple years ago. And what I liked about that was it was all restored and beautiful, and it looked like it was made yesterday. It was amazing looking film. And yeah, it was almost like, dude, that looks like Charlie Sheen, not Martin Sheen. Like, it was weird. How everyone just looked amazing, and it didn't look like an old movie. But I think for the rules of what we do here, I think you're totally right. We should do what put it on the list in the first place.
And then if you have time and you want to also watch Redux, that's cool. I don't know if I'll have time to do that or not. Maybe I'll take a peek at it. Depends on how, because you can stream them for free.
Right.
With ads.
Right.
But Apocalypse Now, the theater edition, is available on IMDb TV.
Oh, I haven't used that Amazon yet. I'll use that thing now for the first time.
Yeah, and the Apocalypse Now Redux is available for free on Vudu.
Oh, okay.
So you wouldn't have to pay for either one of them, really. And then if you want to pay and not have to deal with the ads, CBS All Access has the main one. So mm-hmm. when I say pay for the service.
Sure.
And Showtime has Redux.
Oh, look at that. I didn't realize how much stuff they had. This seems like a cool thing.
Well, you're looking at IMDb TV now?
Yeah. Well, is this all just commercialized, though?
Yeah. And I don't know how they do it. I don't know if they interrupt your viewing with commercials, or it's just commercials at the beginning of every time you press play.
I'll have to go dink with it.
I haven't experienced it myself.
Yeah, I'm curious about it. When I heard about it, I was curious. Now I'm even more curious. I'm IMDb curious.
I've heard that. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, it's fine. Explore you. All right. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the show.
Oh, and don't forget, we're going to do the special New Year's Eve.
Yes. Episode. Yes. New Year's Eve. We'll be doing on the 31st. But Tom and I, we think, didn't we say 4 p.m. Mountain? I don't remember now.
I think it's 3:30 Pacific, so 4:30 Mountain.
That's
wrong. We're going to be in the half hour, so halfway through we can count down to it. New Year's in London.
Yeah, exactly. I'm so glad we got that. So we're doing that. It'll be a live stream. We're doing it for charity, and you'll be able to find all that information soon. I think it'll all be simulcast on everybody's channel. So if you want to go to
on the Frog Pants channel, but I think also on the Ritual of Misery.
Correct. Channel. I believe so. So frogpants.tv or twitch.tv/frogpants, either one gets you there. And we're looking forward to that. We'd love to have some of you along. And if you can, give to a good cause. And then there was another thing I was going to say. What are we doing next week? I don't remember. Are we doing just a normal show? Normal
next
show.
Next week is TV.
Right. Is it or isn't it?
Is it or is there an episode next week?
Or is there even one?
There is an episode next
week. Oh, you know what? There's not one next week because next week
is... Because Thursday is like, I'm gone.
Yeah, you're gone. Yeah. No show next week, everybody.
I'll be in the Japans.
Yes.
Y'all can watch Shogun and to understand what my trip will be like.
Yeah, that scene where what's his name gets peed on by a shogun master. I'll remember that part when I think of you. That's what I'll do.
Yeah, that'll be happening to me next week.
Or when the guy barfs in the prison. I'm going to think of that as well.
Yeah, that'll be happening to me.
Anyway, that'll be, so no show next week, and then we will be doing the New Year's business the following, well, on the 31st. So look forward to that. We hope you're all having a wonderful Christmas time, like the song says. And don't forget, go to currentgeek.com. Also, we need your support at patreon.com/currentgeek. For everything else, currentgeek.com. Got a way to contact us there, all that other stuff. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Welcome back to Legal Geek. This week we explain a recent story of how YouTube got into trouble with the Federal Trade Commission over COPPA, and the controversy surrounding how the settlement is being applied to content creators on that platform. Back in September, the FTC settled a case brought against YouTube for alleged violations of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, also known as COPPA. COPPA has existed since 1998. And the law requires websites directed towards children to obtain permission from parents before collecting various types of personal data from children, ranging from name and address, all the way up to browsing history and persistent identifiers like cookies. So what happened here? On a public forum, YouTube marketing agents were telling some major brand representatives that they were the number one spot for attention of kids and could help them target advertisements to children using the information they collect on those users. But there was a glaring problem with this assertion. YouTube did not go through any hoops to allow parents to give permission for child users to allow collection of such personal information. Thus, the state of New York and the FTC jointly brought an enforcement action for YouTube violating COPPA. YouTube settled the action by paying a $170 million fine, as well as agreeing to business practice changes. And that's where the internet controversy comes in. As many content creators on YouTube, podcasts, and other platforms began to worry about the new practices YouTube was implementing to shield itself from further COPPA liability. YouTube is now requiring, as of January 1, channels to affirmatively state whether their content is directed to children under 13 or not. If they indicate the content is directed to children, advertising is basically cut off, aka their revenue stream, and other features like comments on videos are also unavailable. If they indicate the content is not directed to children, the status quo applies, but with the risk that if this statement is false and the content is later found to be actually directed to children, COPPA can be enforced against the content creator with a penalty of up to $42,000 per violation. A public comment period was twice extended on this implementation issue, and the FTC may yet modify the settlement terms with YouTube depending on the public feedback. However, understanding the FTC a little better may help quell the initial concerns content creators have. First, the FTC is a limited government agency. Even though the agency employs over 1,000 investigators and attorneys, they handle all types of consumer protection and privacy breach issues, not just COPPA. As such, there's only so much attention to go around, and if you look at most of the enforcement actions taken by the FTC, it's usually against bigger companies or blatant offenders of these laws, not gray area cases or small businesses. Pragmatically, the FTC will make sure YouTube implements a reasonable policy here and then sticks to it, and then they will basically move on to other investigations and new cases. Relative to concerns that tracking bots will look for cartoon images or bright colors, like in Pokemon content, and automatically flag that as directed to children, the enforcement of this policy necessitates more care than YouTube's automated policing of potential IP infringement. It has already been confirmed that a human review will occur of content that may become flagged as directed to children on channels that state they are not. And while no system is perfect, one would think a human review, an actual human discourse with the parties involved, would lead to proper results most of the time. Thus, the risk of content creators getting booted onto the non-advertising, non-commenting COPPA version of YouTube is small, and the risk of being fined for COPPA violations is even smaller. The FTC has discretion to apply fines or reduce those fines depending on the defendant's circumstances, and innocent content creators on YouTube are not going to be hit hard, if at all, by such monetary sanctions. It's not like copyright infringement where the other party is trying to maximize the set damages, as in the Napster file-sharing cases from 2 decades ago. The bottom line is, the FTC settlement and fine against YouTube was a big deal, and will lead to significant business practice changes on that platform. However, for those content creators not really directing their content to children under 13, pragmatically any risk of losing advertising revenue or being fined by the FTC is minimal at best. So the sky is not falling here, and following a period of initial adjustment to the new practices in early 2020, it should be business as usual for all our favorite content creators. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter @BuckeyeFitzy.